Good afternoon. So far in our course, we've covered, started out by covering a bit of how we can't hear me at all. Okay. Good afternoon, this time with the mic unmuted. So far in the course, we've covered building programs, sort of using tools like Make. We talked about sort of some lower level things, particularly talking about hardware and operating systems. We talked about a bunch of things that the hardware does to help support operating systems. So we talked about exceptions and building context switching on top of that. We talked about virtual memory. We talked about some OS abstractions we see a lot that are built using hardware support that allow us to keep programs separate from each other. So we saw about system calls and permissions. We talked a little about networking. And connected to that, we talked a bit about, well, if we have a network and we don't trust everything on the network, how can we communicate that way? We talked a bit about cryptography for that. We moved on to our latest topic, which was caches. And we're going to finish up, hopefully, talking about caches today. And also talk about some things with caches and virtual memory. In particular. And then we're going to start talking about what is going to be our topic for the lab on Wednesday, which is going to be about starting new programs and what the interface for that looks like. So last time I wasn't here, I believe Skoudrin went over some review of set-associative caches, which maybe I communicated incorrectly how much you need to do that. Talked about write policies for caches. So when we introduced caches, we talked about all about how you can read from caches and not sort of how we deal with what when the program writes. And we found out that we had these choices. We had two big choices. We had this write allocate versus write no allocate choice, which is what do we do if we're writing a value and it's not present in the cache yet? And we have this write back versus write through choice. What do we do if the value is present? Do we store it right away in the next level or do we defer that? And we learned to defer that, we need to store this extra information about the value being dirty, so we remember later on to actually store it, and don't have to do this for all the values we're just reading. And I believe he also went over different types of misses. So we can kind of, thinking about designing caches, a big thing we want to know is like, well, we have lots of choices. How many sets do we have? How many ways? How big are our blocks? And we want to think about, well, you know, how do these choices affect the sort of programs we're writing? And one way to think about that is we can categorize the accesses the programs do based on why, based on our cache parameters, they're misses. And we have this sort of taxonomy where we said we have these cold or compulsory misses that were things we just couldn't avoid because it's the first time we were loading something, or, well, couldn't avoid without something different. We have these conflict misses, which are that we just, you know, had sets that weren't flexible enough, so we didn't have enough ways in our sets. Yeah, these capacity misses where our cache just wasn't big enough. And we also had something we'll talk about in a couple weeks, coherence misses, because if we have multiple cores, we need to keep the cores in sync, and that's gonna, in fact, require removing things from the caches sometimes. So questions about things we covered last time? Yes? So question, if I have a miss when I'm reading from an array, does write allocate and write back also apply to that? So it doesn't apply to that access in particular, but it does affect, for example, what we need to do when we evict something, which we might do based on a read. Sorry?
For evicting, yeah, does it policy
count? Question, for evicting, do these policies also count? So the write back policy is we save work on write by having more work on eviction. So the effect of these policies on accesses we do later is that an access might cause an eviction, and when it causes that eviction might be more work if we have a write back policy. Does that answer your question? Yes.
Question.
question, what's the difference between a cold miss and an eviction miss? So eviction miss isn't a term we learned. So I don't know what it means. A cold miss is always the first time we're accessing something. And whether a cold miss is a cold miss or not is about how could we have avoided that miss. And for a cold miss, we can't have avoided that miss because we haven't accessed that block before. So we have to have, there's nothing that would, unless we're doing some extra stuff, there's nothing that would put that block in our cache no matter what else is happening. So it doesn't matter what's being evicted or not, whether something's a cold miss, because if it's a cold miss, you know, even if the cache was empty before we accessed it, didn't have anything else in that set, we'd still have a miss.
So you still have a cold miss even if the cache is completely full?
Question, can I still have a cold miss even if the cache is completely full? Absolutely. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so I'll do a little bit of anonymous feedback. So one question I got on Tuesday evening was, could I go over question 6 on quiz 6? And I think it's a little late, because probably if you had problems on this question, you figured it out during the lab. And obviously I wasn't here on Thursday to do this, but the question was asking, what's evicted from our cache? And it was asking what data is evicted. So the way we figured it out is we said, oh, we're accessing index 4. So I looked at the row labeled index 4. And we found out that the tag didn't match. There was something stored there, but the tag didn't match. And what we're going to do is, well, we're not going to have a cache hit. We're going to have a miss. And we're going to have to bring something in to replace what was there. And when we replace something in our cache, we always replace a whole block. So that's how we determined that the answer was that whole block that was evicted, not just some part of it. The question gave you the offset, but it didn't actually matter. Questions on this? Okay, and so some anonymous feedback about the lab being frustrating because you could get almost wrong answers. So I think there's two things going on here. So one is our intention was that the lab would be done in a place where you could get help from TAs and the like, not that you would be struggling on your own. So you could like figure out why something was wrong rather than trying over and over again. My impression is that not all, but a lot of the cases where people kept trying the access pattern exercise and not getting everything quite right is if you were not taking into account least recently used. So a common confusion is you say least recently inserted versus recently used, and those are two different policies. So in particular, if you have hits, that affects what we evict later, because we don't want to evict something we just hit, even if we inserted it a long time ago. And that would be a case where you have like minor differences in the answers. For the lab, if you were there in person, we did in-person checkoffs where you didn't get everything right, but we wanted the TA to look at what was understand what was going on before giving you full credit for that. And that's not really something we can did with a remote submission, because you know it's hard for us to tell, did you just put in random numbers for when you didn't know what was going on, or were you actually having some method that we could figure out why these things were not wrong? Questions on lab issues? Okay, and some positive feedback, and the quiz content taught in class was not sufficient for quiz 7. So I wasn't in class on Thursday, but I thought it was, with one exception on the quiz, I underspecified the last two questions, which I understand was a mistake. Also saying, I wish the examples would go into more depth in class. I'm not sure which examples this comment's referring to. I think, except the cache examples that did not involve C code, I think were about as in depth as I could imagine them being. The ones that did involve C code, yes, those could maybe be more in depth. But maybe you're referring to some completely different sort of examples. And also specifically on the caches, gosh, the readings don't seem very useful. Can you put me into additional resources? So I believe, assuming I updated the website correctly, that I added some links to some possible resources on the readings, though I don't think they have like really extra information, but if you want alternate ways of explaining how caches work. But getting these consistently for every topic is a little tricky because, you know, there are different resources available for different topics because we're kind of straddling operating systems and architecture and networks. And generally, you don't find a single textbook that covers them all in a reasonable way, or a single other type of resource. So, questions on anonymous feedback? Okay, and I feel like I should go through quiz questions 4 and 5. So we have this code here, and we were asking about the writes, the accesses to array 1, and how many reads and writes that would cause with different policies. I forgot to specify whether the caches were write allocate or write no allocate. In question 4, we said they were write through. So regardless of whether it was write allocate or write no allocate, every time we did a move into array 1, we would access the cache once. And because the cache started empty, and we only access array 1 to write it, it would be a miss. And then when it was a miss, if it was write allocate, we'd allocate a block in the cache, and then with the write through policy, write it through. If it was write no allocate, we wouldn't allocate a block in the cache, and we'd just send it to the next level. So in either case, each write would turn into a real write to the next level. So in that case, we have 2,048 writes, because there are 2,048 iterations of this loop with one write per iteration. With a write back policy, assuming we do write allocate, we'd have 32 reads. Why 32? Because there are 32 cache blocks, and we need to read each one the first time we write to it. Why do we need to read the cache block when we write to it? Because if I write to the first byte of the cache block, I want to get the rest of it in that cache, and I have to read from the next level to do that. We won't actually write to the next level, because we don't need to do that until it's evicted, which doesn't happen until after this loop runs, if it happens at all, which it might even not even happen. Yes?
For write allocate, write through, wouldn't there also be 32 reads?
Oh, for write allocate, write through, wouldn't there also be 32 reads? Oh, yes. Sorry. Yeah, so sorry, it should be plus 32 reads. You are correct, and I should add that to the key. So that should be an additional accepted answer on the key. I should have specified write no allocate or write allocate. I neglected to do that, and no one, myself and TA who read, TA's who wrote the quiz didn't notice it until today. Yeah. So the question is, what about the accesses to array 2? The question had in bold for the accesses to access array 1.
But it's asking like to read and write to array 1.
Yes. So the question said to read and write to array 1. So the accesses to array 2 were not what we were trying to count.
But to write to array 1, don't you need things in array 2?
I see. So you read it as I was intending for a very direct cause and effect, and that is not how people read it. Okay. So I guess I have a whole bunch of other answers to accept. Is that actually how I phrased it? Okay. The question says to... Okay. Yes. So my intention here was that how many times will we contact the memory to read or write values in array 1, like to have the memory do that operation. I didn't think about the interpretation of, oh, because we are reading and writing values in array 1, we're reading and writing from memory other things. I'm not sure how I should have phrased that to make that clearer, that I didn't care about the accesses to other parts of memory. But that was the intention, so I guess I need to think about the key a bunch. Okay, or drop the question because why this has way too many interpretations. But okay, accesses to handle array 2 because it's needed in order to. Okay, yes, but my intended interpretation was the in order to was describing why we were talking to the memory, not why we were like doing this access in general, doing accesses in general. Yes?
Maybe it wasn't clear, so what's
Question, why did I have array 2 in the question? I wanted to only ask about writes, and I wanted to make it clear that we couldn't, that we wouldn't just be consolidating the writes as like what, as a sequence of simple writes. But okay. So I will need to think about that quiz key a bunch afterwards. Okay. Sorry about that. Okay. Yes.
If write now allocate, does it have any meaning for it to also be write through, or can it only be write through, write back through?
Question: could it be write now allocate and write through? Absolutely. And that's in fact the most common way write through would be configured. Which is part of why I didn't think about it, because usually write through and write now allocate are kind of best friends, and write back and write allocate are best friends. But like, it's not required. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yes?
Does a write back only occur when there's an eviction?
Question, does a write back only occur when there's an eviction? Yes. So in write back, we defer the actual write to the next level as long as possible, which is going to be when there's some reason it has to be evicted generally. Okay. And a schedule note on today, I'm going to cover the lab tomorrow is on forefront exec, and I'm going to look at the clock, and I might skip ahead to that topic so we have it for lab. Apologies if that happens, but just so you know what's going on. And I believe last time when Skadra finished up, we were looking at this picture of sort of thinking about cache designs generally. And one thing, you know, the kind of thing I want to get across here is that if we think of like how long it takes to access the cache, we have a bunch of different factors that are kind of in conflict. So one factor here is this miss rate. How often do we have a cache hit, or how often do we have to go to the presumably much slower next level? Another factor is the hit time. How long does it take when we have a cache hit? And these are typically in conflict. If we want to make a cache which has fewer misses, it's going to take longer for it to have serve a hit, because we're going to have to look up in some physically bigger data structure. We're going to have to like check more tags and consolidate those results. And this means that when we increase various parameters that tend to help with our miss rate, we're going to tend to hurt our hit time. So someone designing a processor is going to have to like look at, kind of guess like what is the actual trade-off and find a sweet spot between these. There's also a third thing we can think about, which we kind of usually glossed over, which is the miss penalty. If we have a cache miss, how much time are we spending? And this sort of factor, well, we can actually control that by adding a secondary cache. So that's why we have level 2 and level 3 caches, because that makes it as if our cache is connected to a faster memory. Because, well, the cache most of the time is a faster memory. And we can also see it has some other effects. So for example, if we make the block size really big, that would give us fewer misses sometimes, but it also means that when we do have a miss, we need to read in more from the next level. Or if we have to evict something, we'd have to write out more to the next level if we had write back policy. And there are other changes here. And there's one other policy I'd like to mention exists, which is here I've labeled prefetching. So one thing that modern processors do is they want to deal with cold misses, those compulsory misses where we've never accessed a value before. And that seems really hard, right? Because the cache doesn't see the value in time. But what we can do is we can make guesses as to what value you're going to access and try to fetch it in advance. You might say, why is that possible? Well, if we think of accessing an array, let's say you access the beginning of an array at address 10,000, then you access the next element in the array at address 10,004, then you access the next element in the array at address 10,008, it's relatively easy to make hardware which will find this pattern and access the other things in advance so we don't have those cold misses. And that is something that modern processors, in fact, do. Yes?
What is
miss penalty? This is the extra time if a miss. Time to handle a miss. So this is usually the time it would take to go to the next level or main memory. Does that answer your question? Yes. Question, does missing take more time than prefetching? So the reason prefetching is going to save us time is because we're going to do the accesses before the program needs them. So they're still going to take the same amount of time, but we're going to do them while the program is doing other things. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I'm just kind of curious because the miss penalty, it takes time when you miss something. Does it also not take time to load something into a cache when you're prefetching?
Question, does it also not take time to load something into cache when you're prefetching? It absolutely does. But this is something the cache can do while the program is doing things not with the cache.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
I was wondering, I thought compulsory misses happened when a cache entry was accessed for the first time, so it only happened for empty caches. But it seems like the actual
So the question is, you thought a compulsory miss only happened when we were loading the cache the first time. So so that description is not quite true. Compulsory miss is when we access the value from memory for the first time, regardless of what the state of the cache is. And the reason it's called a compulsory miss is that the only way you could avoid the miss is by having somehow accessed that value before the program even asked for it. But whether something's a compulsory miss doesn't matter if the cache is full or not. And what the value replaces doesn't matter for a compulsory miss. It just matters that, you know, there's no time in the past when that value was could have been in the cache. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I'm just confused because
as described as access for the first time, it didn't realize that's for constant memory. Okay, yes. Other questions? Yep.
So for accessing an address memory for the first time, is that like accessing a new tag, or is that like accessing a new tag?
So the question is, what do I mean for compulsory misses about accessing an address in memory for the first time? So I mean accessing that cache block, which would be the tag plus index, for the first time. Okay, other questions? And another way we can view these trade-offs is we can think of them in terms of our mistypes. So this is where the mistypes are useful. So if you can run a program in a simulator and determine, oh, this program has a lot of conflict misses, or this program has a lot of compulsory misses, and determine where you as a hardware designer would want to spend your effort to speed up that program. And that's kind of the main utility of that division of cache accesses into the different types of misses. Questions about these trade-offs. Okay, so our final topic on caching is going to be about a special kind of caches for page tables. So we're going to have to go back to knowing about page tables. So if you remember, we do a page table lookup where we take a page table base register, we access memory to get a first level page table entry. We use that to find the location of a second page table to get a second level page table entry. We keep going till we go through all the parts of our virtual page number, and then we finally get to where the program's data is, and we access memory to actually get that data. And with just two levels, as in this diagram, we have 1, 2, 3 memory accesses. And that's kind of bad. And that's still going to be bad even when these are all cached. And we can also see this in the sort of this diagram of the lookup that's more explicit. So we're going to want to have some special caches to make this faster. It's not going to be enough that these three accesses go to cache. That's still going to be too slow because our level one caches typically take on the order of a few clock cycles per access. And that would mean that a single memory access, if it takes, like, say, 2 clock cycles for each cache access, that's 6 cycles. And that's very slow. So it's just not acceptable. And our fix for that is that we're going to have a special cache just for the page table lookups. And right, ask, why is that cache going to do better than the cache we already have that I told you was too slow? Why are we going to be able to make that cache more efficient? And kind of the intuition for this is, let's think about what a program's accessing when it's running. If I'm running a function in a program, I'm going to be accessing the code for that function. And I'm going to be accessing some stack space. And I'm going to be accessing maybe some global variables it deals with. And this is going to take up some space in our memory, but each of these spaces probably isn't going to be that big as far as pages go. Because a page, remember, on x86 was 4 kilobytes. If your function uses 8 kilobytes of stack space, that's 2 pages, and that's a lot. That's like a, you know, 1,000-entry array in your function's local variables. If your function's code takes up 8 kilobytes, that would be 2 pages down here. That's a lot of machine code. That's hundreds, maybe thousands, probably thousands of instructions. And most functions aren't that big. So when we're running a typical function, we're only accessing like 6-ish pages maybe. And this means that we can get away with having a cache that is really, really small, and we can still have a very high hit rate. Extremely high, much better than our L1 cache would typically be for data. So, the way of thinking about this is we have really, really good temporal locality. And this is just because each page is really big, and it only needs one page table entry to represent that whole big thing. And this means that we can have a very, very small cache. So we're not going to need to have our caches be like 32 kilobytes for caching this. We're going to have a really, really tiny cache, and we can make that really, really fast. So we're going to have a cache, which is going to be called a TLB, or Translation Lookaside Buffer. This is a name IBM came up with way back, and it's stuck, even though maybe we should call it a page table entry cache, but it's called a TLB by everyone, even though, yeah, maybe that's not the best name. And this is going to be this very small cache. So it's going to be similar to our level one cache, but there's going to be some differences. In our level one cache, we look up things with a physical address. In the TLB, we're going to look up things with the virtual page number. Why the virtual page number? Well, we just wanted to get the page table entry. We're not going to use this TLB to get the actual byte of data. That's going to be a second step. So we're going to access the TLB, then we're going to access the L1 cache. So the TLB is just filtering the virtual page number to a page table entry. We're going to check the valid bit on that, and the permission bits, and then we're going to use that to make our actual physical address. So the TLB isn't going to contain any of the program's actual data. It's just going to contain page table entries themselves. So it's going to save us from going to memory to get those page table entries by having them stored directly. And because page table entries represent a lot of data, we're going to generally store exactly one page table entry for a block. We're not going to have offset bits, because our blocks are just going to hold a page table entry. And as I said, this can be very small, so typically a TLB would be like tens of entries, rather than like a cache. Now one cache typically these days is like thousands of blocks. Yes? So the question is, are we just not going to use the offset bits, the page offset bits for this lookup? Yes. And there's going to be no notion of offset in our lookup because our blocks only hold one thing.
Would we decrease the size of like what's stored in the TLB because we just don't need those bits?
Question, would we decrease the size of what's stored in the TLB because we don't need those bits? So we're not going to store anything about the lower 12 bits of the address for TLB, if that's what you mean, yes. Other questions? So we have our TLB. So our TLB, we're going to have it just cache valid last level page table entries. You might say, what about invalid ones? We're just going to just make a decision that, well, that shouldn't happen very often, so it's not worth caching. For those, we're going to look them up and find an invalid last level page table entry, and then we're going to trigger an exception anyways. That's slow already. We don't care about taking a few extra cycles if it's invalid. We're not going to cache them. And note that this is going to be last level page table entries. So there's going to be a first and a second, maybe a third or level. We're not going to cache those if they aren't the last level. because we can't actually use them to make an address. So when we want to fill the TLB, we're going to have to reread those, but we don't need to do that very often because we have a very high hit rate. So let's look at how the TLB is going to fit into our page table lookup. In our good case, we have this whole page table lookup we could do. We're just going to skip the whole thing. And what we're going to do is we're going to take our virtual page number from our address, put it in the TLB. We're going to get a page table entry. We're going to check if that, those permissions work. And if it's valid, it's a hit. Then we're going to take the physical page number, combine it with the page offset, and we're done. And we skip that whole page address calculation because we did it before. So this is the good case. So questions? What's going on in this picture here? So of course, this only happens if we've accessed this page table entry before, because we have to fill the TLB. So how that's going to work is that when the TLB doesn't have a hit, we're going to do our normal page table lookup. We're going to access the first level, then we're going to use that to figure out how to access the second level. And when we get the result, we're going to use it not only to actually access memory at the right location, but also to fill the TLB. So that next time, we won't have to go through this process again. It will just be in the TLB. So questions? Here, yes.
Why is the TLB small in size?
Mainly because we want to make it very fast. We want the TLB lookup to take, like, at most one cycle. Yes?
What exactly is stored in the TLB?
Like, what exactly is stored in the TLB? Is this going to answer that question? Okay, so we'll get over exactly what's stored in the TLB with this very specific example. So, yes. The question is, if we're only storing valid TLB entries, why do we need to check the valid bit of everything else? So part of this is that I just recycled from the page table lookup, and this is the same logic that's used for, you know, our page table lookup, which is in this case. The other thing is that, you know, we also have, you know, valid is the same thing as is it a TLB hit. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so let's look at the TLB contents. So our TLB, it's going to be organized like a cache. Here I have a two-way, so an associative TLB. So we have sets, and we're going to look up using our virtual page number. And we're going to split our virtual page number into an index and a tag. We're going to use the index to determine what row of the cache to go to. And of the TLB, that is, and we're going to use the tag to figure out which of these entries actually has the data we want. And rather than storing data bytes, we're storing here page table entries. So each of these things here is a page table entry. So it like has a physical page number, it has the permission bits, and maybe some other metadata. But this is exactly what we would have retrieved from memory is going to be encoded here. And ultimately, what we're going to get out is an actual page table entry like we would get from memory going through that whole lookup process. Questions? Yes?
At this point, why don't you just store the data?
Question, why don't we just store the data? So the data is the page, right? So the page is about 4 kilobytes. And there's two issues with that. So one is that that would make our TLB not small anymore, which means it would be very slow. Another issue is that our cache, we're designing to efficiently cache the data, and our main L1 cache, L1 data cache and L1 instruction cache. And we're going to design those to cache the data on a smaller granularity than actual pages. I guess something that we're not going to test on, but I guess it's maybe worth mentioning, is that I'm portraying this as we look up in the TLB, and then we go to the actual cache. There have been processor designs which go to the cache and have the cache store things based on virtual addresses instead of physical addresses. And that would be a way of kind of achieving the goal you have of like, why not have the cache use the like the virtual page numbers. That creates some complications because, for example, we can have two virtual addresses that map to the same physical address, and that is something we have to deal with if we did that. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Can you give some examples of the metadata from the page table entry?
Can I give some examples of the metadata from the page table entry? So the only ones metadata we learn about is the valid bits and the permission bits.
Valid bit and the what?
Permission bits. But if you look up in processor manuals, you might find processors want to support extra features in the page table entries. And so they could have extra bits used for that, or they could give bits that the OS could use to store its information about pages. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So if we think of our KLBs, let's go through example here. So on my desktop, I have 4 kilobyte pages and 48-bit virtual addresses, and my desktop has a 64-entry, four-way, level 1 TLB, level 1 data TLB, yes. In fact, Intel has decided, when they made my desktop processor, to have separate data and instruction TLBs and also a level 2 TLB. Yes. So the question is, by 64 entries, do I mean 64 indices? I mean 64 page table entries can fit inside it. So it has fewer sets than that. So if we think of how many sets it has, that this whole thing here, this area is going to be 64 things. So this is total 64, which means that it's going to be four ways and 16 sets. So can anyone tell me how many tag bits are there? Or how many index bits? Let's start with the easier one. Sure. Okay, you have 4 bits, and you said this is because there are 16 sets. So 16 sets, 4 bits, and this is the same calculation we did for our normal caches. We figured out how many rows there are. There's 16 rows because we have 64 entries, so 64 blocks, or blocks are page table entries, divided by 4 ways because that's how many entries per row. So we have 16 rows, and that means we need, that's going to be equal to 2^4 sets. So we need 4 bits to determine what index to go into the row. And our tag bits, someone tell me, how would I calculate that? Someone who hasn't gone, but I guess I'm not getting those volunteers. Okay. So first we want to start with the virtual address size. I like this. So we have 48 virtual address bits. And we want to subtract the index bits. That's good. Now there's a step here which is, I think, a little subtle being missed. So is that if we look at this, our virtual address is this whole thing. But the part that's actually used here is doesn't include the page offset. So one thing you want to do is remove the page offset. You also wanted to do adjustment for the ways. We don't do that. We figure out which way we use using this tag. So we do need the tag is how we do that, but we don't have a way identifier because, well, we want the flexibility of using any of the, in this case, 2 ways. In my processor's case, 4 ways. So we're going to have to subtract an additional quantity here of minus 12 page offset bits. And this is going to give us a 32-bit tag. So I subtracted the page offset bits because the TLB is only about pages. It's not about parts of pages. So we don't care about the page offsets. Some questions on how I figured this out? Yes?
I thought the TLB would store only the page, like a part of the page that it fetched number that is on the last page, not the whole version page.
So the question is, because it only has last level page table entries, don't I only need that part of the virtual page number? No, because I guess there's two ways of thinking about it. So one way of thinking about it is replacing the whole lookup. So we want the answer to be different depending on what that first part of the virtual page number is. And another way of thinking about it is that, you know, we're kind of like making like a little hash table of our, but from virtual page number to actual data. Not, that replaces the whole multi-level page table structure. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yes? So the question is, if it's a miss, how do we have the information to traverse through the page table? So I kind of glossed over some details here, but presumably there's going to be some internal register in the processor that has the address we're trying to access. And there will be something which says, oh, this was a miss, let's do the expensive thing using that internal register. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, other questions? How do I get the page offset bits? Since our pages are 2 to the 12 bytes, that means 12-bit page offsets. Because we need 12 bits to determine which of those 2 to the 12 bytes we're referring to. Does that answer your question? Okay, yes? Question, is the page size always going to be the TLB size? I don't see how the TLB size is 4K here. Yeah, so, yes, so they're not related, and I think this is, okay, other questions? Yes, back there.
So does the block offset matter at all?
Question, does the block offset matter? No, and the reason why is that each of our cache blocks is exactly one entry. And that's kind of like if we had a data cache, if each block was exactly one byte. Okay, same kind of idea. Does that answer your question? And I guess a way of thinking about why you would design the TLB this way, why don't we put multiple page table entries in a block, is because, well, that's only useful if there's good spatial locality, but pages are already so big, there probably isn't. That we're probably only using one page at a time. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, how does the page offset figure into this? The page offset isn't used at all in the TLB lookup. So here we take just the virtual page number, put it through the TLB, and only after we process that page table entry do we actually use the page offset, but that's not part of what the TLB does. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
What's the difference between a cache line and a block?
Question, what's the difference between a cache line and a block? A block is a term for the actual data in a cache, and a line is a term that sometimes means the same thing as a cache block, and sometimes means the block plus its metadata. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yeah.
So in the TLB, after you have figured out like the virtual address part, and then would you put the physical address as like where it maps to, like the next line?
Question, would I store the physical address where it maps to when I get a virtual address? I store the physical page number the virtual page number maps to. I handle the fact that the whole page maps together by using the page offset at the end like you see here.
So that would be where you put it.
So the question is that this address I make by taking my page number from the entry and the page offset is where it actually go? Yes. Other questions? Okay. So I have our TLBs. So let's do a little run through of what the TLB access looks like, and then we'll go on to our next topic. So here in the TLB, let's say I have this sequence of accesses to these virtual addresses, and let's say I have 4,096 byte pages. So that means that this is our virtual page numbers. So they're not the whole address, and the TLB doesn't see the page offsets. So all it sees are these virtual page numbers, and we're going to split those virtual page numbers up into an index and a tag. In this case, our TLB has two sets, so the index is 1 bit. So we do our first access here, and we find out that it goes to set 1. We're going to check set 1. It's not there. It's going to be a miss. So we're going to read the page table entry, doing the whole page table lookup, which might be multiple levels. And then we're going to put that in our TLB so it's available for next time. So then we're going to access here. And this is also set 1, and we check the tag. That's the rest of our virtual page number. The tag matches, so we have a hit, and we return that page table entry. That gets combined with our page offset, which is how we end up accessing physical address FFF038. Then we do that again with a different page offset, but same page number. So we have a hit. Then here, I have an access to set 0. I again check, if something is here, I find out it's not. So I'm going to load the page table entry, doing my whole page table lookup. That means it's going to be available later. Then I have another access to our second entry. Again here, I'm checking set index 1. I'm comparing my tag, find out it's a hit. I get my FFF, combine that with the rest of the address, get a hit. Then I have an access to set 0. I check the tag matches, and I get my physical page number is 310. I combine that with my offset of FE8. And have a hit. And then here, I have an access to address that ends in 0, so it's index 0. I check the tag, it doesn't match, so this is going to be a miss, and I'm going to have to replace that entry because I only have one way, I don't have any other place to put it in that set. My new entry, and that means that my final access here ends up being a miss. Questions on what happened in this sort of example of how we might use the TLB when running a program? Yes? What's the blue highlight in the VPN column? This is our TLB index, which in this case is just 1 bit because we have two sets. And the rest of the part that's not highlighted, that's our TLB tag. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yes.
When we have the miss on the last address, why would we not replace what's at index 0?
The question is, when we have the less than max address, wouldn't we replace that? Yes, we would. I just didn't write that in.
Okay.
Because I just haven't gotten that far. Yes.
For this access pattern, the first three misses are compulsory and the last one is confidential.
So the question is, for this access pattern, would we say the first three misses are compulsory and the last one's a conflict? I think that's accurate. Other questions? Yeah.
So say in the last line where you map 7C FE0 to page FFF, would that be the physical page of the data, or would that be the address of the last
The question is, when I map 70FF0 to FFF, this is an error, actually. This should be 310 to be consistent with the rest. Sorry about that. Does that make more sense? Yeah. This is, again, editing slides late. Okay. That should be 310 because it should be the same page table entry we got earlier, unless something changed, which is possible, but seems unlikely. Other questions? Okay, so in our last 20-ish minutes, we're going to talk about making processes. So this is going to be our conclusion of TLBs. We're going to have an assignment on TLBs later, but I think we have enough, hopefully, understanding. We might review it later if we need to. So we're going to talk about process management, and you've seen the Unix functions for managing processes. You've seen some of them. You've seen getPID. You've seen kill. We're going to talk about functions for, and you've seen exit. We're going to talk about functions for creating processes and running programs. And the first question you might have here is, wait a moment, why are these separate functions? Isn't that the same thing? And in some operating systems, the answer is yes. But Unix and POSIX is the sort of standardized version of Unix that a lot of, that like OS X and Linux follow, for example, separates these two operations. So we have one operation called fork, which makes a new process. And we have a separate operation called exec, which changes what program the current process is running. So you might say, wait a moment, if creating a new process doesn't change what program is running, what does it do? What is the new process doing? And the answer is that it's going to be a copy of our current process. So fork is a function which copies our current process. And because there's a copy, now there's two processes, and they're both still running. Because, well, it was running originally, so the copy's still running. And it's going to return twice, therefore, once in the original and once in the copy. And there is a deliberate difference in the copy that, well, the new version has a new PID, and the return value of fork is different depending on whether you're in the original or the copy. If you're in the original, the return value is the new PID that we created, where the copy is. If you're in the new one, it's going to be zero. And we're going to call the original the parent and the new one the child. And we're going to duplicate everything but PID, the PID, to make this happen. So how does this look? So we have our process info that the operating system stores, and it has a pointer to our page tables and all our memory. And kind of conceptually, what would happen is that we're going to copy all that information. And it's not just going to be a shallow copy. It's in fact going to be a deep copy. So we're also going to copy all the memory. And that's what fork's going to do. And after we do that copy, we're going to slightly edit the return value so they return different things. And we're also going to set a different PID field. So PID here is going to be the child PID. And this is going to be a parent PID. Yes?
So the 42 that was previously in, like, the parent REX, was that just arbitrary?
Question, the 42 that was in the parent REX, is that just arbitrary? Yes. Other questions? Okay. So this is, as the slide notes, this is kind of the slow version. So this seems kind of bad because we're copying all the memory of our program. And it's in fact worse than that because probably we're going to replace this with something else right away. So we don't really actually need to copy everything, hopefully. And there's a trick we mentioned when we talked about page tables that's most commonly used to avoid doing this whole copy here. We're still going to do this copy, but we're going to avoid that copy. And that's copy on write. So let's say here that the parent runs first after the fork. So when we do the fork, we're going to copy the program info. But rather than copying all the program's data, we're going to make a new page table that points to the same pages. And we're going to mark them all as read-only. Then, when the parent writes to one of these pages, we're going to make a copy for the parent, assuming the parent writes first. And we'll do the same if the child writes to one of them. We'll make a copy for it. So everyone has an independent copy if they actually write. But if they don't, which we'll find out is actually very common, then we'll never make a copy. So questions about this sort of copy on write idea? Yes. The question is the purpose of copyright just to save memory. So that is one thing it does. Probably a more important attribute is that it speeds things up. So setting things up to look like this just involves editing the page tables, but it doesn't involve allocating any additional memory. And allocating the additional memory takes time. So this is probably going to be a lot faster to do. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So that's our copy on. So let's look at an example of what fork does. So here I have a program where I print out my PID, and then I call fork, and I have this my return value. Remember, my return value is different depending on whether in the parent or the child process. In the parent process, we get the new PID. In the child process, we don't get that. A way I remember that's how it works is that, well, we can call get PID in the child process to figure it out, but we can't call that in the parent process to figure out what the new PID is. So in our parent process, where we get a child PID that's greater than zero, we're gonna get our PID again, which should be the same as this one, and we're gonna print that, hey, my PID is the parent of the child's PID that I got. If we're in the child, fork is gonna return zero to indicate we're in the child process and not the parent one. And in this case, I'm gonna print out that I'm in the child. And I also have this else case. If fork fails, why would that happen? Let's say we're out of memory. That's probably the most common reason, which just handle that and print an error in that case. So, yes? What does the fork method do? So it causes our process to be copied. So it does this whole operation. So it means after fork returns, there are now two copies of our program with two different sets of register values, two different sets of memory, that are now going to run independently. And what happens here is that, you know, what might happen is first, before we fork, we print out PID 100, but then in our parent, we print something out, and in our child, we print something out, and those both happen in two separate programs. Two separate processes, I should say, that are running the same program. Does that answer your question? Question, why am I doing if else on the child PID? So we can think of, we're running our program. So this is like represents our, we're running the printf here, printf, parent PID, and then we call fork. And fork is going to split our program into two. And one of them, we're going to have child PID equals, let's say in this example, 432, and the other child PID is going to be zero. So what our if statement is doing is going to mean that in our original parent process, we're going to run this stuff here because of our if statement. In our child process, we're going to run the child process part because of our if statement. So it's ensuring that the two programs that were originally just copies of each other, we're using this information that lets us know which one it was to run different code depending on whether it's the original or the copy. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yes, back there.
Does it happen after the specified order in the third line?
So the question is, the order of these two prints fixed? No, it could be either order. That's why it's an example output and not the only output. That answer your question? Yes.
So for the else if branch when child PID is zero, which indicates that yes, it is the child process, how does get PID know to execute under the child process and not the parent process?
The question is, when we're in the else if branch, how does get PID know to execute in the child process, not the parent? It can't do anything else because at this point we're dealing with this set of registers and this separate program. So it's as if we read. So as far as the operating system is concerned, this is a different process that is running with its own memory, its own process ID, its own open files, and so on. So when you make a system call, it looks up, what's the current process? Well, it's the new one, because that's where I got the register values we're using and all that, and the page table and so on. Does that answer your question? Yeah. So the question is, where would the switch happen? So I guess maybe something which would make this more explicit is that we're going to have, is that if we have a single core, we're going to have a context switch from the parent to the new child. Right, because these are actually separate threads with their own registers and so on. So in order for the child to eventually run, we're going to need to have a context switch somewhere to make it start running. Yes.
So when it piles down to the assembly, would you compare wherever you're storing child locating, would you compare that to zero and have a system call the context switch accordingly, something like that?
So the question is, where would we have the context switch happen? So the context switch, we don't know where that happens, but there doesn't need to happen explicitly, because what fork's going to do, it's going to make a new process that could be switched to. And at some point, the OS will decide to switch to that for whatever reason. Maybe it took too long. Maybe there's a core that doesn't have anything to do. But we're going to make a new process, and we can switch to that process. So that's going to happen eventually. Is that? Yes. Question, why is the child PID 432? So fork policy is that it returns the new PID in the parent only, and it returns zero as kind of a signal in the as a sentinel value in the child process. So that's why we're checking for zero. So because zero is just a special value for fork. Answer your question? Okay. Yes.
Does the parent and the child processes, are they gonna have anything that maps to the same chunk of memory? For example,
so the question is, will the parent and child process share memory? So because of copy on write, they will probably end up sharing memory, but that's not going to be sort of visible as far as being able to modify something in the parent and see it in the child. If you want to set that up, we've learned how to do that in lab. Using that shared memory idea, you could do that to communicate between the parent and the child, but fork is not going to set anything up like that for you. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So let's do an example to go over more of how fork works. So here I have a program here. I want to have two possible outputs of this program. And remember, what's going to happen is our program's going to be running. We're going to call fork. That's going to kind of split us up into two processes that get scheduled independently. So they can run at different times depending on when the OS decides to context switch, or if we have a separate core, how fast that core runs relative to the other one. We have two things that the OS can run. I'll give you a little time. question, or? Okay. Who would like some more time? Okay, who can give me one possible output? Yeah. So we'll have in child and then what? And done, okay. Anything else? So if we think of this scenario, our child process, this is what our child process will do, but the parent process will still be running. So after the fork, we'll have our child process will run these things, but our parent process will also run, and it's going to run at some point and also run these two things. So that could be the correct start of the output, but then let's say our parent process runs. In that case, we might have child 100 done for that to finish up. Does that make sense? And so does anyone have a different answer? Yes. Okay, so you're saying, oh, we could have in child, then we could have the parent gets to run, because maybe there's a context switch, or maybe we have two cores which are running kind of in close in time. Child 100, then we have done and, what, anything else? And done again. Right, because we have done running twice, because that runs in both the new and the original, the new process and the original one. And I have kind of a diagram to help think about what's happening here is that we're going to run after the fork. There's going to be two programs to run, and the OS gets to decide, based on what's going on, when exactly they get to run relative to each other. So if we have different sort of patterns and when we switch between them, we'll get different outputs. But we still end up running, you know, the whole rest of the main in those programs, both programs. Questions about this? Yes? Is the PID 0 for the child process? Yes. Should it be 99? The convention is that 0 is the indicator. That's just a choice they made. I'm not saying it's the right choice, but that's the design POSIX has chosen, is that 0 indicates child process. Yes?
What if you fork the child again?
What if I fork the child again? Then I would have, the child process would have a child of its own, sometimes called a grandchild process, and that would run at, you know, interleaved or at the same time as, depending on how many cores we have, as the other processes, and its output would also be interleaved. Does that answer your question? Yes?
With the PIDs of the child and the grandchild, would they both be 0?
Question, would the PIDs returned by fork both be 0 for the child or the grandchild? So if we hypothetically called PID2 equals fork here, then that would happen right at this, I should use probably a different color, right at this point here, and we'd have a case where in a new process we got 0, yes, the grandchild process, and in the old one our PID2 would be the PID of the new process. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so we've talked about fork. We're probably going to review that more later. Let's talk about the other operation, running different programs. So there's a function, a family of functions which start with exec. That's what the star means. So none of them is actually called exec star, but they're all called things that start with exec, and they just take their arguments in slightly different ways. So I'm going to show you one variant of this, which is execv. And it takes a path of a program to run and a list of arguments to supply it. It's argv value. And a way we might use this looks like this. That here, I'm going to make a child new process. But that new process, I actually want it to run, in this case, ls minus l. So if we're thinking of a shell, we type ls minus l. This is what our shell is doing. So in my child process, I'm not going to keep running stuff in my new program. I'm just going to run this exec, which is going to replace my current process with ls. And I'm going to tell it that the program I want to run is slash bin ls. That's where it is in the file system. And The argv's I want to supply it is ls for argv0 minus l for argv1, and the null pointer tells exactly how many arguments there are. Yes?
Bin bash and then run it with the same arguments to do the same thing?
Could I use bin bash as the path here? Probably not. But we could ask the we could run. So the reason why not is because if you run bin bash with bash space ls space minus l, it probably will not do ls minus l. But there is a way of running bash which will do that. But it requires different arguments, which are described on the lab tomorrow. So this is running a program. So we make a new process, and we replace that process with a different program. So what is exec doing? So conceptually, we have our process information in the kernel, and we call exec. And what does that do? It replaces everything in our current process with kind of fresh values. So all the registers go to nice new initial values for starting a new program from the beginning. Our open files stay the same, and all our memory gets deallocated, and instead we load the program from disk, we set up a new stack, a new heap for it, and we copy the arguments from the exec call into its stack. That stack there. So now we have the same process, but when the operating system decides to switch to this process, well, now it's running a completely different actual executable because we've changed all its memory and all its register values. So that's what exec does. So that's why in this usage here, we first created a new process to run ls in, and that meant that our parent process can continue doing things down here that deal with the program. So questions? Yeah, yes?
When using fork, are you supposed to use only thread safe operations?
Question, when using fork, are you supposed to use only thread safe operations? So we haven't talked about multi-threaded programs in detail yet, but if your program has multiple threads, fork only copies one of them. So the new process will not be running the other threads, and that's a consideration you have to make when deciding what operations you should use alongside fork. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think one of the, when I was reading some map pages, I saw the example, and they used the exit with the underscore in front of it. I was just wondering if that should be used always.
The question is, should I be using underscore exit instead of exit? Probably, yeah, the difference is whether functions that handle program exit run, and you might not want those to run for that case. Yes?
So fork is going to start, running when you call fork, right? You're not going to get into like an infinite loop.
Question, the fork is going to start running when you call fork? Yes. When fork, when you call fork, the next thing that happens is fork returns. It just happens in twice. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Since you have to do the work of initializing registers in the stack and makes an exec, is fork generally faster?
Question, is fork generally faster? Fork is slower because we have to do all the page table manipulation for if you have a lot of stuff allocated. So fork is probably slower. Yes. So the question, after I exec v, is it possible to go back? Nope. We've lost the data, right? We've discarded the old memory. It's not there anymore. So before I leave off, one thing I'd like to mention, because it comes up on the lab tomorrow, is that there's also, we need to wait for a program to finish. So the function we'll use to do that is waitPID. It has a manual page, and it's probably the most straightforward of these functions by a big margin, because fork and exec are not straightforward at all. And in waitPID, we can call this function typically in our parent process to wait for the child process to finish and also get its exit status. What is its exit status? That's the number you pass to exit or return from main. So that's, and our lab tomorrow is going to be about fork exact and wait. Yeah. So that's where I'll finish off. And down here for questions.